to who? Whoever it is drops the ball and the guy runs a second.
Yes.
Who picks up the ball and throws it to what? What throws it to, I don't know. I don't know, throws it back to tomorrow. Triple play.
Yes.
Another guy gets up and it's a long fly ball to because. Why? I don't know. He's on third and I don't give a darn.
Oh, that's our shortstop.
I'm Joe's mom's neighbor, Doug, and you're, fill in your name here, and this is the Stacking Benjamin Show. Happy Monday, everyone, or as we call it here, Money Day. Even Joe's mom is upstairs talking about her latest side hustle, finding work for these two dorks. But if you're thinking about trading up for a new job in 2017, we're bringing the help. On today's podcast, please help us welcome the Vice President of Career Strategy at SoFi, Mark Gashy. Plus, a headline about grandma's student loans. We'll throw out the Haven Lifeline to Matt, who has a question about retirement savings, but still have enough gas left in the tank for a letter from Luke, my trivia, and a slice of Joe's mom's San Fantastic apple crisp. And here they are, two guys who could learn to be a little more crisp with this podcast, Joe and O-J-J-J-J-G.
Apple crisp.
Apple crisp.
Yeah, that's so good. You get a little scoop of ice cream on there, maybe a little cinnamon.
You can't
sprinkle a little cinnamon on top.
I am so hungry right now. Hey, everybody. It's another episode. You found us at the Stacking Benjamin Show. I am Joe Salcy. Hi, Average Joe Money on Twitter. And across the card table, Mr. Apple Crisp himself, the one and only other guys. We call him OG.
Although I'm quite partial to peach cobbler.
Oh, but don't. Stop. Just stop. You know what? The one thing you don't want to stop is heading to stackingbenjamins.com/
I thought you were going to say, you know what's really peachy?
Oh, see? It's my head's all cloudy with the... Oh, I totally missed
you're
that.
You're all ice creamed out.
Oh, that's bad. Yeah. Yep. Heading to stackingbenjamins.com/magnify money because when you head to magnifymoney.com, you know what you'll find? Those credit cards you have, you could have much better ones. That whole debt strategy you've got is rotten. Your checking account could be better. Savings account. Why do you walk into a bank and just take whatever they offer when right at your fingertips, you could have over 92% of all of the products that are out there ready and waiting for you? StackingBenjamins.com/magnify money is the place to go when you're putting your financial life in order. And the cool thing is, you go there once, you take care of it all, and baby, you don't got to do it again for a long, long, long time. StackingBenjamins.com/magnify money. Great website. And we're going to have, I'm sure, Nick Clements back on here fairly soon because they had some big announcements coming up, OG. Some big stuff happening over there on the blog. Mandy Woodruff and her team over there doing some investigative journalism and digging up some good dirt. Hey, speaking of dirt, if you think your career is dirt, we're going to help you today because Mark Gashy's here, OG. Mark is the vice president in charge of career development at SoFi. You know how SoFi helps you find a job?
I do know how SoFi helps you find a job.
That's not just lip service. They have...
Oh, this really is.
They actually have people that help people find jobs, and Mark Gashy's job is to lead that effort. So he wrote this great piece called Trading Up for a New Job in 2017. Here's your six-step game plan. I said, well, you know, we're not big readers. Can you come talk to us about it? Mark was nice enough to say hi. So he's upstairs talking to mom right now. But we're going to get to Mark soon, but we've got a couple great headlines first, so let's move.
Hello, darlings. And now it's time for your favorite part of the show, our Stacking Benjamin's headlines.
First headline comes to us from the Huffington Post. This is by Zach Carter. Of course, you can read about this anywhere, OG, not just HuffPo. Student loan debt crisis is driving elderly people into poverty. This is scary. Student debt is forcing tens of thousands of elderly Americans into poverty, according to a new Government Accountability Office report. Article says that the findings here are startling. More than 110,000 senior citizens had their Social Security checks garnished in 2015 to pay off student loans they'd already defaulted on. Nearly 70,000 Americans over the age of 50 are living in poverty as their Social Security benefits are cut to pay off their student loans. Man, this isn't just a problem for junior anymore, OG. This is It's a big old problem.
The government never forgets, do they not? I mean, holy shnikes. Yeah, it's amazing how many conversations I have here and there with clients that are in their 50s that have student loan payments.
Student loans back from the day or student loans where they're
No, from them. Their student loans.
No, I mean from, so did they get re-educated?
No.
Did they go back to school or these are back from way back when?
Way back when.
Yeah.
Because the problem is that they let you defer them forever.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, you just click the box and go, nah, forbearance. And what's your reason for the forbearance? I don't have any money. Okay. Because the government knows. It doesn't matter. Eventually, they will be made whole.
It just takes your word for it.
Well, they take your word for it, but they also know that it doesn't matter. Even if you are full of crap and you make a bajillion dollars, they're like, well, we'll just take it out of your Social Security check at some point in time.
Yeah, we're going to get our money.
With or without your assistance, it will eventually come into back of our pockets. That's tough.
It says the federal government's profiting from this mess. Every time a debt collector scrapes a Social Security check, the U.S. Treasury Department collects $15. It's amazing to me, OG, how quickly this problem's getting worse. It says since 2005, the total student debt owed by Americans over the age 65 has increased nearly fourfold. And I think maybe that's just what you're talking about, which is the escalator just kept running and these people got older and older and didn't make any payments. And so now the other shoe's dropping.
Well, and think about it. Our generation, well, maybe not your generation.
Easy.
But the front end of your generation, the back end of your generation where I'm at, I think we're probably one of the first ones to have, you know, substantial amounts of student loans and more specifically our parents to have them for us, right? Did your mom or dad take out any parent loans for you to go to school or no?
No, my parents didn't take out loans.
My parents did one for 1 year and then they said, yeah, we're done. Wisely on their part, might add. My dad said, I hope you enjoyed that 1 year of college because that's it. That's the gravy train is over. But I still, I mean, mom's paid it off long since, but she's now of that age, right? Where she borrowed $10,000 for me to go to college my first year in the mid 90s. And now she's 65. She could be one of those people.
It's funny. This goes back, it says in the article, to past presidents spending time on the stump talking about how important higher education is and how we want more people to have higher education. So we're going to make student loans more available for people. And now, you know, of course, then we look years and years later. Now we're seeing the other side of this. But I think, just like we talked about before here, OG, you still got to sign your name on the student loan. I mean, you can say, well, yeah, the president made a speech and I felt like, yeah, well, that's me talking to me. But there's got to be a cost benefit to anything that you do in life. And maybe some people got robbed when they took out loans for a degree that looked like it was going somewhere. But look at the number of degrees out there that you think you took on that much student loan for that degree.
Yeah. Yeah. That's one of my conversations that I have with clients. If they ask about going back to grad school, you know, I look at it purely from a cost benefit standpoint. Well, what's the return going to be? It's going to cost you $50,000. You're going to be out of work for 2 years, or you're going to be in work, but working, you know, maybe part-time or at a lower wage or something like that to do what? To get a $5,000 pay raise on the back end. The break even on that's, you know, 10, 12 years down the line. That's not, that doesn't make sense.
Well, something's going to blow up here at some point. It sure seems like.
Sure seems like that, huh? Something's got to give.
There's another foot and I can't say.
Leak in the dam.
We don't have any guidance. I mean, do we have any, I don't know what to tell people that have, you know, don't have the money to pay their student loans and their Social Security is being taken away and they're in poverty. It's not that easy.
Yeah, there's not, what do you say?
Of an answer. I mean, there's no ruby slipper. It's time for side hustles.
I guess. I don't know.
You know, time for more, make some more money. I don't know what to say. I feel awful. That headline made me feel horrible. So let's move on to another one that makes feel even better. This comes to us from financialplanning.com. This piece written by Andrew Welsh. Looks like a company OG saying, well, you know, on second thought, maybe the old way looks pretty good. Listen to this. Merrill could pivot on their fiduciary pledge. I love how the words pledge and pivot are in the same sentence there. Merrill Lynch may consider delaying or reversing some previously announced policies meant to comply with the fiduciary rule that now probably will never be.
No, it will be. You'll see.
Including a pledge to cease offering commission-based retirement accounts. Andy Sieg, head of Merrill Lynch, says his firm has been working to deliver a, quote, best interest standard of care for clients, but he says that operational changes are possible if the rules delayed or overturned. President Trump made recent moves to do just that. When asked if Merrill would stick to its previous commitment to phase out commission-based retirement accounts, Sieg demurred. It's very hypothetical, he says. We're going to operate on a best interest standard. In other words, what's in our best... Yes, what's in our best interest? Right. Isn't that funny? It's like not doing what Ameriprise did that we reported last week or a couple of weeks ago where they said, well, we're going through with it.
Merrill Lynch is like, we've already spent the money, we're onto it.
Yeah. He says, to the extent that the law is changing, we'll always have programs in place that operate within the law. Well, isn't that good of you, Merrill Lynch?
That's nice.
You're going to operate within the law. Good for you. I love this quote from the Consumer Federation of America. It's not good PR to be publicly walking away from a best interest standard, says Barbara Roper, Director of Investor Protection. How would you like to be Director of Investor Protection? That's quite a... She wears a badge to work every day, I'm sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah, she does. So then they're not walking away from it. They're going to still operate under a best standard. It's just going to be their definition of what's in the best interest. So we're not walking away from it. We're pivoting.
You know the big brokerage firms, and this is what this post goes on to say. Merrill usually is kind of a first mover around the big brokerages, and people kind of follow in the big brokerage houses what Merrill does, especially when it comes to the retail side. I think when it comes to some of the mergers and acquisition stuff, don't they more closely follow what Goldman does? But in this case, sure looks like Merrill's saying, yeah, big brokerage houses.
Oh, they just did a cost benefit calculation and said, yeah, we're going to take it on the chin for walking away from this, but not to the extent, but we'll make way more money on the commissions that we're going to maintain, you know, the accounts with, or are going to continue to charge.
How do you explain that to your client?
Yeah. Well, it's a pivot. Yeah, we're really pivoting to a best interest standard. It's really what's in our best interest.
Right.
The thing that's in our best interest, Mr. and Mrs. Client, is that we continue to charge you commissions.
And by the client is not part of that hour.
Because, you know, the fact is if we went bankrupt, that really wouldn't be good for you, Mr. Client. So this technically is in your best interest. As long as we're profitable, you have a place to do, you know, get your advice.
As an aside, you and I went through very similar training programs. Do you remember learning that line of baloney?
I can neither confirm nor deny.
I totally remember learning that whole line of baloney. I know exactly where you got that. I think I know the person who taught you that, which is just an absolutely horrible. You're like, can you say that with a straight face? Yeah, it's awesome. That's just
your
great.
Best interest to keep me afloat so that I can stay here. Because if I fail out of this business by not charging you a commission and I can't feed my family, then who are you going to turn to?
Right. Then you lose. That's why you want to pay me as many commissions as possible. Way, way, way back in the day. Oh, my goodness.
Long time ago.
Long time ago. Those were some ugly days. Hey, so the lesson here, I think, though, OG, is just because the fiduciary rule may not end up being a rule doesn't mean you don't have your own rules. Have your own rule where you say, hey, guess what? In our house, we're going to ask if you're a fiduciary.
You don't need the government to tell you that you have to act in your client's best interest or that you have to find somebody that acts in your best interest. There are other advisors out there that are already legally obligated to do that.
Plenty of mechanisms already in place.
Yeah.
Plenty. You just got to know the right words to say, and we just gave them to you. So, yeah.
Are you a fiduciary? Is a great way to start.
That's lesson number one. Lesson number two is thinking about more education, cost benefit analysis. Man, it doesn't always work, but it definitely is your first line of defense against having your Social Security garnished.
Oh man!
Holy cow! Mark Gashy has a job that I would love to have. He is Vice President of Career Strategy at SoFi, and he's there for a good reason, OG, because for 25 years, he's been in the for-profit, nonprofit sector with universities teaching management and career advice. You've heard of a few of these places like Capella, UCLA, University of Chicago, maybe. Northwestern University in the Kellogg
School. Never heard of
him. Kellogg School of Management. He wrote a piece that I just absolutely loved over on the SoFi blog, and I said, you got to come on and talk about this, Mark. And he's been gracious enough to do that. Let's talk about trading up for a better career in 2017. Mark Gashy coming down to the basement. And Mark Gashy joins us in the basement. Have a seat, man. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
Well, I'm better now that you're here because you're going to help us all get a better job, which I'm excited about because Mom says, you know, we can't stay in the basement forever, Mark. We have to get a job. By the way, before I ask you any questions, I have to ask you one thing about your bio, which is you are the vice president of career strategy at SoFi. What does a vice president of career strategy do, Mark? Do you walk around and comment about everybody's career?
Yes, I manage the careers of every employee in the office. No, that's not my target audience. And if we back up a little bit, right, SoFi is a modern finance company where primarily we service members of the community that want to refinance their student loans, take out a mortgage, life insurance. And as a part of our community, we call our borrowers members. And we have, different from our competitors, key member benefits. They focus on money, relationships, and career. And so I had a group of people that develops and delivers career services, career coaching, career tools to our membership. If you look at our business, a healthy career is an absolute necessity for being eligible for our products and building a great life.
It's funny. I've often wondered, and it's another reason why I think SoFi is so cool. I've often wondered why banks don't do that, because if people keep their job and they have their financial house in order, they're more likely to make the payment on the loan.
That's right. Yeah. Mike Cagney, our CEO, I think when he started the business, quickly understood that in the loan business, you have to mitigate risk. And risk comes in the form of people that are in circumstances where they miss a payment or two. And then ultimately, you know, what you don't want to see on either side is someone defaulting. As you dig into the reasons behind why people sometimes struggle to make payments and keep up with their loan, job loss, unemployment, reduced income sits as the reason for a lot of these people that need assistance, and there's really no one to turn to. And so we have created a member service that meets the needs of our members and meets the needs of the business.
Well, let's talk about meeting the needs of Stacking Benjamin's listeners. See what I did there? By going through
nice.
This. Yeah, going through this six-step game plan. You wrote a great article for the SoFi blog, and I wanted to walk through this because when I read your piece, I thought, this is something we should talk about on the show. And your steps here, if we just go through these, Mark. Number one is to check your career's vital signs. What does that mean?
So much as you see your doctor for an annual physical, I think it's worth in the first quarter of the year, January, February, March, assessing and really taking stock of where you are in your career. And by that, I mean, over the course of 2017, it's good to first understand what's your goal. Right. Stephen Covey is famous for saying, begin with the end in mind. He wrote the 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. I believe that that is not a bad strategy for thinking about a 12-month period. Where do you want to go? Do you want to get promoted? Do you want to change industries? Do you want a raise? Do you want to move teams internally? Once you take a look at your goals, then you can start to understand, are there things that you need to do proactively to reach that goal and to make it happen? I think that in our work with our members, often people drift into a place where they expect their company to do more than they're actually willing to do, right? So you're waiting, you're doing a great job, you hope someone will tap you on the shoulder and promote you. That's just not the way it works these days. You've got to advocate for your own career, create the dialogue with your manager proactively, manage your career with your company and your organization to get where you want to go.
Yeah, I am a big fan of management guru Tom Peters, who talks a lot about, why are you waiting for your company to train you to do a better job? Why don't you go out and create your own training program? And this is kind of an offshoot of that, it seems like.
It is. I think that companies nowadays are extremely lean. If you look at training departments and you look at the professional development that the companies actually pay for, it's usually fairly thin, and it may not be the comprehensive solution set, just to your point, that you need to move your career forward. Maybe it's a couple online courses. Maybe it's a professional association that you should join and then present at. Maybe it's finding a mentor outside the company. So when we work with members and we hear that they're taking advantage of company resources only, then we start to circle back to what's your goal and is the company offering enough? Some companies are wonderful at offering some of these benefits, but they probably don't offer the complete suite of solutions that any number of people might need to get to the next step faster and to, in our language, trade up for something new in the 2007 year.
Your next point is to connect with your network. And I guess that assumes that you're on LinkedIn and you've done a good job building a network, because I think a lot of people have let that atrophy.
Yeah, I think that, the unwritten part of number two, connect with your network, is make sure you have one and make sure that you're tending to your network so that when you read an article like this and you hear connect with your network, you have one, right? And the people in your network know you. They've interacted with you recently. Here's a good example of connect with your network. I was talking to a member who has a job, who's trying to think about the next step. And we talked about LinkedIn. And I said, you know, are there 30 to 50 people that if you were laid off tomorrow, you would want to tap for conversations, for help, for assistance? The member said, absolutely. And I said, ask yourself what you've done in the last 6 months to connect, to reach out, to add value to their lives and their businesses, sending an article, checking in, saying that you might have heard there was a birth in the family, anything that conveys that you are staying in touch, that you care about them. And so the member, you know, heard that and said, you know, probably not as much as I should, right? I haven't been on LinkedIn for 3 months. And my point to the member was always be ready, right? You never know when that day comes when you're going to need your network, and you probably can't predict it. And so if you keep kind of tending the garden that is your network in LinkedIn, when you need a change, either driven by outside forces or within yourself, then you've got it at the ready.
I'm a big believer in systems, Mark, and what you're saying rings true enough that I think that this isn't the type of thing that you just say, well, you know, I'll get to it at some point this week. I think you'd have to put this time in your schedule, don't you?
So a lot of books these days are referencing the phrase creating and sustaining habits. So habits seem to be a theme that people are writing about. And I think LinkedIn and networking is a habit, right? You've got to build it in on a, as you said, in a system on a regular basis, and it's got to be written down and you got to check it off, as opposed to kind of some vague notion of, well, I'll get to that when I have time. Well, there probably won't be any time. You know, our members are highly educated. They're ambitious. They want to move up. They don't have much time. And so building it in intentionally, I think, is key. And the other thing to mention about this point is that, and I'll make my point inside of a member story. I was speaking with a member 2 weeks ago, and we were talking about his job search, and he has a resume that is diverse, right? He's done lots of different things in different industries and functions. He's a multi-talented guy. So his resume doesn't read as kind of a stair step or a ladder of progressively more responsible jobs in the same field, and it all makes sense. He was on the job boards 20, 30 hours a week. And so the challenge to him was, don't apply for any single job that you see online at all, never in the next month.
Never.
And not at all. And network, have lunch, have coffee, be on the phone, tap the hidden job market. Don't compete with people on Indeed.com. Now, if one of those conversations leads to an actual job posting, then he is to apply to that job, but use that networking connection to be a referral into a person, first name and last. And, you know, the last 3 weeks, his job search has turned around. He's getting more traction. He's got a couple interviews. So I think the big fallacy is that job boards appear to be for the job seeker, and that's not the case. Job boards are paid for by employers. The job boards, their business model, they're funded by employers. And so it's appealing to spend time there, but it's simply not effective.
You say 85% of job seekers find their new roles through networking. So what a great story to put a cap on that point. The third point, it surprised me, Mark, when you said consider the grass might not be greener on the other side. You might not want to leave.
You might not want to. So I'll frame this in a member story, someone that I talked to just as I joined SoFi in December. And a lot of people come in to work with a career coach or counselor, or in my case, my career strategy team, and their instinct is to leave where they are, right? Something has happened with their boss. Something has happened inside of a reorganization, and they're not happy about something that has gone on. And so the trigger is there, and the go-to response is, I'm going to leave, right? That I would be happy elsewhere. I could get away from these here and now problems. And yet what we see in job seekers is if they don't change the way that they manage their work and manage their career, they're simply hopping to other employers and other organizations where if they act the same, then nothing changes. You know, what I'm always asking people is there something at your company that is fixable, right? Is there something that you can change about your environment, your relationship with your manager? And if you can, I would do that first, right? So questions like, does your manager know your career goals? Are you working with leadership to be mentored and to be trained for another role? Are you taking advantage of all the professional development that your company can offer? So if the answers to all of those are no, then it's likely that that person will go to the next job and exhibit the same behavior. Right. And so it's the introspection of, might I be getting in my own way by not managing my career internally the way that I should? And the best way to approach this is to find someone inside your company who does similar work, who is a star, who has gotten promoted, that has thrived. Ask them to have lunch and quiz them about what has worked for them. How did you get there? How were you promoted so quickly? People have answers to these questions, and there are individual cases all around you. And if you can tap those people, they will tell you how they did it.
We had Amanda Steinberg from dailyworth.com on. She's the CEO there. And she was talking about hitting the reset button. It seems like if you find a star, the business that you're at now, they can almost hit the reset button on a career with a company that you think's going nowhere.
Perhaps. I think that if you've invested in the company and they've invested in you, you have the relationships to get to a new job more quickly or a new assignment more quickly. Inside of this, what we always say to our members, and I also say it to my 15-year-old son, because it's true no matter what age you are, and that is, if you want something, you should ask for what you want. So any number of our members inside of coaching, we will find ourselves pausing and saying, so I just heard you articulate how you want your manager to support your career. Have you told her that? And the member will say, well, no, I actually don't talk to her about that. And then it's a dialogue about, well, what if you did? How would you phrase it? And what do you think the benefit might be of asking for what you want? Because after all, managers are busy and they're probably not reading your mind the way that you would want them to. Ask. Be clear about what you want.
Which also sounds like a discussion with a 15-year-old there, Mark, too.
I have the discussion with myself. My wife has that discussion with me. Whenever you are in a relationship, right, you are hoping that someone will understand your needs without saying it out loud, because that feels good. But on the other hand, do you have the patience and time to wait months, weeks, years for the company, in quotes, or the organization to figure you out? As a manager myself, I love employees that come and say, Mark, this is what I'm thinking. This is what I believe I want. I'd like to enlist your help. That's a formula for getting ahead.
Number four confuses me, because it seems like the reason to make a jump in your career is always for more money. I would think most of the time, I mean, this is a money show. We talk about stacking $100 bills, but you say,
right.
But you say take money out of the equation. Is that because it might pay more, but the job might stink, or what's the deal there?
Sure. Well, Joe, I worried about this coming into the interview because stacking Benjamins and taking money out of the equation don't necessarily fit in the same room. And so I'm still a little nervous talking about this, but let me try to explain what we mean by this. I think that if you really dive deep into the values of an individual who is looking for a next job, a next opportunity, it's not just about money. And if, in fact, you moved just for money, you'd still be having a conversation with that person about all of the other daily, weekly experiences that they have around work satisfaction, job and role fit, belief in the company, finding purpose in work. And so just getting a job for more money actually is not that difficult. But I think that just as soon as you get more money, it wears off very, very quickly. And so what we want to focus on with our members is, what about purpose? What about meaning? You know, with the millennials that are now 80 million employees and the biggest part of the workforce, in general, these are the questions that they're asking. What's my purpose? How does my purpose align with what the company cares about? How can I be successful in my role and be viewed as an accomplished worker? If you hone in on those particular factors, I think you can find jobs where the money is there. And so think of this as profit, right? You're trying to make a great product and a great service. The profit is the outcome. It comes later if you've done everything right in terms of building your business. So build up a role, build up a career that makes sense for you, and then find pockets in the economy where you're making the money that you want to make. And for sure, there are pockets that make more money than less, but you need to understand where you're headed before, you know, the money equation comes up, especially as you're selling yourself to an employer, right? Your motivator can't be money said out loud. It needs to be your ambition to do certain work, your skill set, the value you can bring, and then you can start screening for salary and compensation.
You know, as I'm listening to you talk, I'm thinking about a friend that I spoke with just last week, and she has a great career in marketing, moved just 6 months ago to a new firm, actually moved from Chicago to Arizona, you know, moved across the country, and it was mostly for a lot more money, and she lasted there less than 6 months because of the fact that all the other things you talk about really didn't end up being there. And you know, 4 months into the new job, she and her new employer are completely butting heads. And it seemed like, and she even says this, that it, had she done some more exploring, she probably could have uncovered some of these problems before she took the job.
I think that that is an all too common scenario. I recently worked for the Kellogg School of Management and worked with students and alumni that have their MBAs. And you might guess that that population would be chasing higher compensation, job after job after job. But I think once you realize that money, prestige, and the optics of where you work are all external factors, and what is making you happy or unhappy during the day is all internal. How you feel about your work, how you feel about your organization, can you get behind what you're doing? And then most importantly, is your role a great fit? Are you doing things that you both love to do and are skilled at, right? That's the sweet spot. Right. I really like it and I'm skilled at it. And if those intersect, we stop watching the clock. We stop dreaming about 5 o'clock and we start to flow into our work and things become easy. For this woman in your story, my guess is things got really hard and the money started to become not enough to justify the move and the position.
It's funny that you said flow into your new work. I don't know. Were you referencing the book Flow? That's one of my favorite psychology books.
I was. And, you know, if you understand flow just at a thin level,
right,
when you're doing something that is, you know, quote unquote, natural to you, again, where there's talent there for sure, and there's a lot of desire and interest and passion, when those are happening together, you can spend 2, 3, 4 hours on something and not realize that all that time has passed. It's a great place to live because you're out of your conscious mind and you're focusing fully in the work and you're immersed. You know, in essence, that's what we want for our members, for their jobs over time to incrementally be more of work that is kind of in this flow zone.
I'm running out of time quickly here, Mark, but there's two more on this list and I'm going to lump them together. Number five, don't burn your bridges. Number six then is, of course, commit to your new employer and manage your career. It sounds like continue to manage your career the way you're managing it now. But this number five on burning your bridges, do people still do that? I mean, I don't know. Maybe I've been around the block for too long and I think that's the worst thing you could ever do is leave a company and immediately on social media, give them the one finger salute.
So I agree that it seems not plausible in today's age that people would burn their bridge. I would say that some people scorch their bridge. So they might not burn it down, but they might leave a trail of people that view them differently. So a good example is as you're heading out of an organization, there are lots of opportunities for you to give feedback to the organization, your manager, HR, other folks. Sometimes because of the experience being challenging or stressful or difficult, employees are, in quotes, honest, meaning they share precisely why they left, precisely why they were so unhappy. For the employee leaving, there's no upside for that other than an opportunity to vent. And I would suggest that employees and our members vent to people that we love, vent to a coach. But there's no reason to end your employment experience with all of your gripes and all of your complaints. In fact, I would do the opposite. I would come from a place of appreciation and being grateful, right? You meet with HR and they say, what do you think? And you say, I'm grateful that I got to spend time here because I improved my skill set. I was exposed to new things. I made connections. And that is going to sustain all of those people staying in your network, being available to you for all time, as opposed to the last thing they heard is that you were terribly disappointed in everything that happened during your tenure. That's just simply not the taste you want to leave. That's simply not the impression you want to leave with former coworkers.
I think that's a great place to end it right there, Mark. So one last question about your role at SoFi. Any big new initiatives coming up the next 6 months that you'd care to tell us about?
Yes. In fact, we are growing our support for members in a really significant way this year. Three of our focus areas that we've dedicated ourselves to with respect to blogging, social media, we offer live presentations to members in different cities across the country. We're focused on personal branding, so how to develop and maintain a great reputation and brand in the workplace. We're focused on, we talked about it today, networking, building connections in a very advanced way. You know, how can you become an excellent, outstanding networker? And then lastly, our members are intensely interested in a topic that overlaps with your passion area, and that is, what is my value and worth in the workplace? We get that question often, and it's a tough question to answer. There isn't a calculator on the web where you put in your qualifications and who you are and it spits out a compensation number. Right. And so, you know, what am I worth? Am I receiving what I'm worth in the marketplace? Yes, no. If no, how do I claim my worth? What does that look like? And inside of that, salary negotiation, lots of work this year to educate our membership, provide opportunities to engage in dialogue across all three areas.
That's so exciting. And if you're out walking the dog or on your run or driving to or from work or someplace else, we'll have a link to this article from the SoFi blog on our show notes at stackybenjamins.com and also to the fine work that Mark's doing. Mark Ashe, thanks for hanging out with us.
Joe, thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Hey, trivia fans, I'm Joe's mom's neighbor, Doug, and Monday has a lot of symbolism in my life, you know? Like, Monday morning symbolizes how much I hate alarm clocks, and Monday right around noon symbolizes only 4.5 days left of this drudgery before it's the weekend. You know, that kind of important symbolism. But here's a trivia question for you. Where did the name Monday get its origin? Ponder that for a minute, and I'll be back.
Hey, Stackers, it's time in the show for us to help you solve your money problems. First of all, if you're somebody with a bunch of credit card debt, you've got to change that behavior. Let's work on changing it. The first thing we have to do is get open. And we asked Nick Clement, the CEO of Magnify Money, head to stackingbenjamins.com/Magnify Money to reach them, why people don't talk about their credit card debt.
I know. I wish we would. If you remember when you're in school and you look left and you look right, and one of these people will. Well, one of these people will have credit card debt, and it probably will be you at some point in your life. And because we don't talk about it, because we're so ashamed, we're so embarrassed, what we end up doing is nothing. We stay put. We don't come up with a plan to get out of it. We don't negotiate better deals and refinance. And so it just becomes this horrible, quiet problem that can make someone feel awful. You shouldn't be ashamed. Almost, one out of two people have it. Speak up. And only when you talk about it and deal with it can you get out of the problem.
So of course we don't talk about it, but you know what? If you don't hold yourself accountable, you'll get nowhere. Then once you decide that it's time to make things better, head to stackingbenjamins.com/magnify money for not just better credit card options with 0% interest rates to help surf your debt to lower rate, but also for better savings accounts and checking accounts.
The following is an actor, not a real person. We tried to find an actual Stacking Benjamins podcast listener, but we're not sure any exist.
Yesterday, I turned on one of those other podcasts. Ugh, more money talk? The topic was something called long-term care, and they couldn't even make me care for the short term. That podcast made me feel like just another number.
Hi, I'm Joe's mom's neighbor, Doug, the huge star of the award-winning Stacking Benjamin show. Are you tired of podcasts that blabber on about money? Are you confused about all this IRA, SEPP, 72T, and fiduciary talk? At Stacking Benjamins, you're not just another number to us. Heck, if you actually listen, you're the only number. That's why we barely ever talk about money. Better yet, we treat you like family. We'll invite you on down to Joe's mom's basement, serve you some pie and maybe even a little lemonade, and best yet, when you leave, we'll complain about you behind your back. Because that's what real family moments are all about.
I'm never going back to that old podcast. Stacking Benjamins is a way for me to avoid numbers and feel that warm, fuzzy feeling I get every time I scream at my sister on the phone.
Stacking Benjamins, where you're not a number. Your family.
Hey, trivia fans, and welcome back to the best part of Monday, my trivia. Here was today's trivia question. What is the origin of the word Monday? What I was surprised to learn when I was researching the science behind this question is it goes much further than that old Bangles song, Manic Monday. Who knew? The name Monday came about in the Roman era from the phrase dies lunae, which means day of the moon. That, of course, became Moon Day, and from there, it was just a hop, skip, and a jump to what is now Monday. If today is really Monday, wouldn't that mean that we should all head downtown for a little moonin'? Nothing brightens the start of a work week like showing those stuck-up b****es down at the flower shop what a pale full moon really looks like, if you know what I mean. Who's with me?
Big thanks again to Mark Gashy for coming down to the basement. I like his thought that the grass might not be greener on the other side, of that move. Sometimes staying put and just better communication with your boss is the way to go, OG.
Yeah. Mrs. OG left her company once, and when she realized that she didn't want to be at the new company, she went back to the old company, and the boss said, "Why did you leave?" And she said, "Well, they gave me more money." And he said, "Well, you should have just asked me for it. I'd have been happy to match it."
I thought about you the second Mark was telling that story. That's so funny. Yeah, thanks a lot. And Mark appears often over at the SoFi blog. We'll have links to the work that he does over at stackingbenjamins.com on our show notes. Hey, let's throw out the Haven Lifeline and tackle some of life's, or rather life insurance's, most important questions. Our friends at Haven Life Insurance Agency, they've been spearheading innovation within the life insurance industry by focusing on those two things you value most, your family and your time. It's why they created a high quality, most importantly, affordable term life insurance policy you can purchase entirely online. No need to wait several weeks for a decision when you can get one instantly with Haven Life. Head to stackingbenjamins.com/Haven Life now to learn more about life insurance, the modern way stackofbenjamins.com/haven life. I had a question the other day about if it's all done online, what if I've got issues? Sometimes you want to talk to a person. Phone support is still available on that if you need it. OG. So always a human right around the corner over at Haven Life.
Nice.
Yeah, good stuff.
But so, not there hounding you.
Not, they're just.
You
just,
don't want them to.
Are you sure you want that family to be protected?
Yeah, I mean,
what would happen?
So Mrs. OG's just going to sell the house, I guess. Kids aren't going to college.
Can I have another cup of coffee while you guys think about it maybe a little more? Yeah, none of that crap. let's say hello to our new friend, Matthew. Say hello, Matthew.
Hey, Joe and OG. This is Matthew from Tennessee, and I'm calling today with a question about retirement savings. I'm currently trying to create my financial plan, and I know that I should try to allocate an X amount of my income for retirement. Usually, I've heard that amount is somewhere around 15% when you're first getting started, so we'll use that for this example. My question is, if my company will offer a 3% match when I've elected 7% of my income to go toward my 401k plan, do I include the corporate match in that 15% goal number? So, in this example, have I saved 7% or 10% of my income towards the goal? Thanks for the help.
Ah, Matthew getting a little technical there in Tennessee. Good stuff. Thanks for the question, Matthew. OG, what do you think there? Is he save 7 or 10 if the company's kicking in 3?
I'm going to always overshoot the goal, so I'm saying you're saving 7 because, you know, the employer match could go away. Now, if you're really tight on cash flow, which is why you're trying to justify that, maybe, is you're going, well, I really want to have some me time. I really want to have some me money in there. So if I do 12 and they give me 3, that's really 15. I'm not going to argue with you about it. The real question is 15 good enough? That's my math question, should it be 18 or should it be 12 or should it be 10? And so as you work on creating that kind of financial plan number, what you want to shoot for is what is your replacement lifestyle going to look like at retirement? Get yourself a future value calculation on what that number is and then say, how much do I got to put in between now and then to make that happen?
Yeah, work backward. It actually isn't that hard to do.
Yeah.
To start with the end in mind and then work back to today to say, what do I have to do to make that a reality? It's funny how many people I met when I was doing the, going to company circuit, talking to them about their retirement plans. And I'd ask people, what percentage are you putting in? And they'd say, 6. Where's that going to get you? What do you mean? I got no idea what that's going to get me. Well, how'd you choose it? It's what I could afford.
I'm not a big fan of these rules of thumb. You know, you hear these on the radio sometimes, like you need to save 15% of your income and then go pay down your house. You don't have to stop at 15. I have had a conversation with a client not too long ago that said, we're at 16, so we want to back off our savings. I'm like, what? Why would you do that? I mean, unless you needed it to live on, right? Like it's okay to still contain your lifestyle into the things that are appropriate for you and save 20% or 25%. You can do that too.
Well, or if you knew you were overfunded and you had wanted to have more fun today. I mean, I knew
that's
people,
fine too.
Yeah. Just know
we want to treat over saving the same way as we want to treat, overspending, right? There's no sense to have $30 million, if your lifestyle is built around $30,000 a year. But if it's just excess, don't create stuff to spend money on just because you've arbitrarily hit this 15% number.
To directly answer Matthew's question, though, I really like what you said, which is do it all yourself. Or if you haven't done it all yourself, realize that if that match goes away, you have to know that you're vulnerable.
Yeah.
Yeah. Good stuff there.
You say it more succinctly and direct than I do. Like I just like talking. Cut the cord, Chatty Cathy. We got a podcast to do.
I'm over here. We're doing the wrap up symbol. Whatever. Yada, yada,
I'm
yada,
like,
man.
I thought you were dancing. Like, whoop, 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 whoop. That's not the Joe wants to dance symbol.
I very well might be dancing with all this NyQuil I'm on. I have no idea if I'm dancing or not.
It's
over
like
here.
Morning, night. That's one of the greatest comedy bits of all time, by the way. The Dennis Leary NyQuil bit.
Oh,
I mean, is that not one of the funniest?
It's so good. That is so good. People are going to have to go look at that.
Speaking of comedy, I've got a really funny thing to share about comedy later.
Oh, boy. Yeah. We also get letters down here in the basement. And for those of you that were listening to us last week, you know that we stopped halfway through a letter from our friend Luke. Luke's second question, his letter OG, was this. He said his spouse and he would like to retire in about 15 years, which is when the first of their three kids could be starting college. Are likely to be supported by a pension, $36,000 about, and by retirement account withdrawals. If the vast majority of our assets are located inside retirement accounts, and since our W-2 income would be zero, would this reduce or possibly eliminate the expected family contribution for FAFSA requirement and potentially be a coup for our kids receiving need-based aid or grants for college? Anxious to hear you guys pick apart this thought. How about that? I've got this one. Because expected family contribution is something that we spent a lot
it's
of time
right
on
in your
here.
Wheelhouse right now.
Right in my wheelhouse, baby. So money inside of retirement plans is, quote, protected. So Luke has that right, that the money's already protected because it's inside of there. Contributions are not. And when you think about the way that the FAFSA laws have been made and the way the FAFSA expected family contribution was created, it all logically kind of makes sense. They say, listen, you shouldn't have to take money out of those retirement accounts to put your kid through college. However, there should be some sacrifice there. Saving for retirement may have to slow down while your kids are going to college. So additions to your retirement plans count when they're doing the expected family contribution equation, but money inside of that tax shelter doesn't count when they're looking at your assets. Money that's in the kid's name, by the way, taxed. And we'll call the expected family contribution a tax, right? Because you're trying to make that number as low as possible so you get aid from other places. So money that's in Junior's name counts way, way, way more.
Way more. Yeah, like 35% or something, right?
Yeah, the money in mom and dad's name. Because they say, you know, mom and dad should be able to have a cash reserve first, number mm-hmm. one, should have some money in the bank, and then we'll start taxing that money and using it in the calculation. But right. Junior gets no cash reserve. Listen, this is your college, or you know, and even if you're junior, we're talked about older people going back to college earlier. So if junior's you, whoever the person is going to school, that person gets taxed. So the answer is yes, Luke. If you have your money coming from a pension and you have your money in tax shelters and your W-2 income is zero, you could look very pretty when it comes to going to, expected family contribution. But it's amazing.
It's a lot of betting between now and then that doesn't change, right?
It is so, I was going to say, it's just amazing how rarely these bets work out versus. So you'll have a lot of manipulation you'll have to do between now and then to make sure that you stay eligible for the free money versus the flexibility that you have of doing things the other way. You're giving up a ton of flexibility to bet that somebody else can pay for your kid's college. And if you end up being wrong, if they change the expected family contribution equation between now and then, you know, there's a problem. So many things can change in the next 15 years. You just don't know. You're betting a lot.
As opposed to doing, you know, a couple $100 a month into a college fund.
Yeah. Yeah, man. That's a difficult bet that Luke is making, but he is right. He is right, OG.
If it were happening today, he would look very pretty.
Expected family contribution from the EFC standpoint. Very, very low. Yeah, it would be very, very low. So good stuff. Thanks for the question, Luke. Sorry we couldn't help more. I feel like Luke's the guy going, but if I cheated my taxes this way, wouldn't it work great?
Yeah, that's not what he's saying. He's being a little strategic about it.
Yeah.
But I get the sense that, yeah, there's some weird justifications in there, right? Like just put a couple $100 in a 529 plan.
Well, and I don't know how weird they are. I get where he's coming from. Yeah, it's such a tough bet. Yeah, good stuff. Hey, if you've got a letter for the show, send those to me, joe@stackybenjamins.com. I'll tell you what, the pile is going to get smaller because on Wednesday we're doing a letters episode. You are the main guest, and we have a ton of letters to get through. Your better bet, and always the shorter line, is to send us a voicemail. Go to the Haven Lifeline, stackybenjamins.com/voicemail to get there. And as always, if you know you need help with your financial plan and you need a better financial planner, head to stackybenjamins.com/OG to get on OG's schedule. It's just letter O, letter G to get there. Man, we did it. My voice held out, kind of.
Kind of, yes. Thank you for qualifying.
For the entire episode. I feel like I'm fading fast, though. This flu has been just a
whooping, huh?
Oh,
just, that's odd because you work from home, you know. Other than me, you really don't see any people.
Apparently.
I mean, you haven't showered in God knows how long.
How did I get it? I've got no idea. You know what? I think I know because Cheryl said the same thing. She's like, you don't go anywhere. It was because I'm one of the organizers of a half marathon. That whole day I was out there, dude, I was shaking hands with so many people.
Yep.
That's specifically.
And then you're like licking them afterward.
Oh, I love that.
Give me your germs.
Yes.
Give me your germs.
Right.
Hey, you got to keep that immunity strong. Even if it takes, you know, a week out of you, you got to test the defenses every so often to make sure that they still man the cannons. Otherwise, you know, all those white blood cells, they just go to sleep on you. And then you get like the super germ and there goes Joe because they ain't been tested in a long time.
I had that cold in the fall where my voice went away.
But it was awesome.
Well, but I still, for you, but I still felt like I could, you know, get around.
You felt fine. Yeah,
do some stuff. Just my voice wouldn't come back. This is the opposite.
Yeah.
It's totally the opposite. I feel like somebody, like an elephant just sat on my chest and yeah, not good. Anyway, speaking of good, Doug, tell us what goodness people should have learned from the show.
What goodness the people should have learned, Joe? I don't think there was any of that. But here's what they could have learned if they were paying attention. Follow Mark Gashy's advice. Take control of your own career. Nobody else is going to level up your success. Grab the reins. Drive your own bus. Second, headed back to college? Do the cost-benefit analysis on your degree before heading back to grab the diploma. But the big lesson from today's show, if you're looking for grandma to pony up a few bucks for your birthday and it doesn't seem to be happening, maybe it's because she's still paying off her student loans. Special thanks to Mark Gashy for dropping by. You'll find our link to Mark's piece on the SoFi blog called Trading Up for a New Job in 2017 on our show notes page at stackingbenjamins.com. You'll find out more about how SoFi works with its members on their careers at SoFi.com. This show is the property of SB Podcasts, LLC. The show is created by Joe Saul-Sehy, produced by Richie Rutter-Reese, and engineered by the amazing Steve Stewart. SB Podcasts may receive payment on the show from sponsors and guests in the form of books, giveaway items, discounts, or other remuneration. There's no way you would take advice from these dorks, but like Joe's mom always says, don't take advice from people you don't know. This show is for entertainment purposes only, and before making any financial moves, consult with a real financial advisor. And super special thanks to Officer Murphy down at the police station for explaining how surveillance videos work. Man, the reflection of my ass pressed up against the flower shop window sure is pale on closed circuit. That alone is worth a written apology to the ladies down at the flower shop. I think we're going to chalk this one up as a little more awkward than normal Monday for your old friend Doug.
So I'm watching this show called House of Lies. Have you heard about this on Showtime?
I thought that's what this whole program is.
Yes, it's my entire family is a documentary.
That's our
House of Lies.
Our existence.
Yeah, it's got it's been around a while. It's on the fifth or sixth season now. But I was bored because I was trying to get on Billions this past weekend. But your favorite show of the year squashed my favorite show of the year. So they didn't run an episode on Sunday last week.
You're talking about the Oscars?
The Oscars, yeah. and I wanted to watch Billions and it wasn't on. So I had some time to kill. So I clicked on House of Lies. So anyway, House of Lies is a story about a management consulting. And so the whole concept is that these guys are like cutthroat management consultants. All they care about is getting the deal.
I watched episode one of this, Don Cheadle.
Don Cheadle's in it, correct. And Kristen Bell.
Yes.
And a couple other people. Yes. It's very raunchy, right? A lot of swearing.
I would say it's kind of a comedy.
It kind of is a comedy. It's a comedy drama. But yeah, there's some funny parts. There's a lot of funny parts in it. Yeah. It's on Showtime. So that tells you what you need to know about, you know, the rating of this program.
Sure.
It's not PG. But man, I'm hook, line, and sinker into this show.
I can't realize why I didn't come back for episode two. I'm watching a new series too, which is called Marcella, and it's on Netflix. It's a British
Dynamite.
Right. It's it's a British serial.
I can't wait to really do that in Europe.
It's a British. Yeah, that'll go over great. Everybody's looking at you like you're the biggest moron alive. Just like everybody listening right now is.
I'm going to have those big Union Jack socks on that go up to my knees.
So there's a serial killer. And and this woman had been investigating them 5 years ago before she left the force. And then the serial killer had kind of disappeared and she quit the force to raise a family. Well, you know, she gets a knock on the door because there'd just been another serial killing. But what's weird is, and this is the hook, she is, you find out in episode number one, she is way more wrapped up in this than you think she is.
Oh, she's been doing it kind of on the side, basically.
No, I mean, she's kind of wrapped up in like who the serial killer is.
Like it's her, maybe.
You really don't know. Like you seriously, okay, yeah. I'm on episode three and I'm like, man, because
it's like 24. You don't know who the mole is, but you're pretty sure it's somebody.
Well, and the other thing is she blacks out. She has these blackouts and she wakes up with blood all over herself.
Dexter. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So she doesn't know. So it's got this really good hook. The guy that played Apollo in Battlestar Galactica the whole time, he's in the show. You've got a few actors that I recognize their faces, but I have, you know, couldn't tell you their names. But man, is it good. I'm on episode, I've watched three episodes and fantastic. Like,
how long are they? Are they half-hour shows or hour-long shows?
No, they're hour-long, so they're like 45, 50 minutes.
Okay, you know? Yeah. House of Lies is 28 minutes.
Right.
That's, so you could just boom, burn through a couple, three episodes in one sitting.
It's really, so there you go. You can watch both. How's that? We gave people a twofer, dude.
That's a twofer.
Right.
All right, buddy. Hey, let's go.
See ya. Dude, I just stopped recording and you're like fired up again.
Well, I wanted to talk about the comedy bit. Forgot about that. We were talking about comedy and comedy shows and that sort of thing. So I can't remember exactly what it was, but there was a show not too long ago that had the a little bit of the Who's On First bit. And it was the joke was that it was the joke, you know. My kids are looking at me like, I don't get it. And so I pulled it up on YouTube. First of all, I don't think I've seen the whole thing ever.
You'd never seen
Abbott and Costello, the 7 minute long version of this.
It's amazing.
It's freaking awesome. So I'm watching this on my phone and my 9-year-old's looking at me and he's going, I don't get it. I'm like, just, and finally he gets it. And as soon as he gets it, his eyes get all big. He goes, oh, this is awesome. Like, and finally clicked that, you know, all these people were actually people's names and not the guy being a jerk. And he's like, I don't understand. I said, just watch, you'll figure it out. Yeah. And finally go. And so he was going around going, I don't know who's on third. You know,
what's on second? Who? I don't know.
No, he's on third. Who's your pitcher tomorrow? So tomorrow's pitching to today. Why can't you tell me today? No, today's catching. Really funny stuff. Okay. Now we can be done.
I got a book on that recently, by the way. I got this book. There's this awesome used bookstore in Fayetteville, Arkansas. And I bought this, The History of Radio Comedy. It is fascinating. I'm up to this group in the 1920s that predated Amos and Andy. I don't know if you even know who Amos and Andy are.
Nope.
But they were.
I wasn't alive back in the 1920s.
Amos and Andy was one of the first groups to do what you're talking about, like the Abbott and Costello, you know, two-man routine. Yeah. Yeah. They got famous later. All right. Good stuff, man. I'm going to bed.
Good idea. See ya.